Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Kemi Charrier.
And I'm Monica Ainley. And you're listening to Fashion No Filter,
where we sit down with some of the lead creatives, strategic thinkers, and emerging talent around us to interpret the ins and outs of the fashion industry today. Hello, and welcome back to Fashion No Filter for our last but not least final lockdown special. Monica and I are still in different countries, but we are still finding ways to record remotely, and we hope that you enjoy this episode. As with all of our other lockdown episodes, we haven't accepted sponsorship, but we would love for you to donate if you enjoy these shows to either the International World Health Organization or the French charity Protège ton Soignant. The link to both of those will be in the show notes. Thank you so much for your donations.
Kemi's given us a gift, and I don't know what it is, but Joel's already received it. And Joel, it just sounds so, like, pleased.
It's yummy.
It's so yummy.
What is it?
We've talked about it a lot, Monica, and it's, like, quite a precious resource at the moment.
It's something that you struggle to find in France, so I decided to send you my favourite from home.
Marmite?
No, better than that.
Peanut butter?
Yes.
No. No. Oh my God, I'm so happy.
It must be so rare in France that someone at customs has stolen it.
Guys, this is a scandal. Someone in Calais is just gorging themselves.
Having
the
time of their life.
What brand is it?
Oh, I don't remember the name. It's a really good one. It's one I
because I know about the brands. I know.
Unfortunately, I don't know all peanut butter brands name off by heart. I get it at Whole Foods, and I really like it.
Oh, wow.
And I checked when you were talking about it whether it was as you seem to be looking, without sugar, without all those things, and it was. It complied to all your ingredient rules. So I felt I would send you a pot of mine. And then I thought that since Joel seemed like he loved it too, I would include one for him as well.
So thoughtful. And so Joel, thoughtful. Is this peanut butter living up to your expectations?
I mean, it's lived up and exceeded my expectations and is now an empty jar in the recycling.
Very happy to hear that.
And would you put that on toast?
I'll have it on toast. I'll slice an apple and put it on a few apple slices. Sometimes late at night, I'll just spoon it into my mouth, you know.
I'm not fussy.
Yeah, the peanut butter finger.
Yeah.
Yeah, peanut butter finger is always a treat, but you can also try them. So I invented a sandwich, which you toast a bagel, and then you put like a lot of peanut butter, and then you just put a little bit of Marmite, and it's called the special relationship sandwich.
Ooh, that sounds absolutely disgusting.
No. Shout out to Maya Singer, who was involved in this invention as well, back in our Avenue 32 days.
Oh, no, this is not okay. I'm a Marmite.
No, guys. Oh, you're an anti-Marmite.
No. I'm obsessed with Marmite. In fact, it's all I've been eating at the moment. It's what I eat when I'm feeling, when I need comfort food. Marmite is my go-to.
Same. Well, peanut butter for me, but I like to put the two together.
Oh, yeah, no. For me, I'm a purist. It's Marmite, butter and bread, and that's it. Nothing else. My dad puts Marmite in coffee, and he has warm water and Marmite as a drink.
Wow.
Yeah.
As a French person, that would be considered highly unacceptable.
People at French breakfast tables actually burk at Marmite. if they know what it is. Otherwise, they just look at you in bewilderment.
Yeah, yeah, I had Marmite toast last night and François made me sit on the other side of the table because he couldn't stand the smell.
Yeah, that's what happens to me generally with Marmite.
Besides from the peanut butter, sorry, crisis, are things back to normal in France, Monica? Because lockdown has lifted now.
Yes, lockdown has lifted. So we are déconfiné. So we were confiné and now we're déconfiné.
So what's déconfiné mean?
Déconfiné means that we don't need, because we used to have a signed piece of paper explaining for what purpose we were outside of our houses. We don't have to do that anymore. You can leave your house, come and go as you please. You're suggested to wear a mask in a store or another, you know, public place. I have to admit, I don't really wear one walking down the street unless there's a lot of people around and then I put it on, but it's quite nice to breathe actual air. I don't think you even technically have to wear a mask except in certain places, but, you know, people are. So you still have that slightly apocalyptic feel, but there's people in the streets, there's people in shops. Like, I'm talking, you know, in a clothing store as much as a grocery store.
That gives me hope.
Le Bon Marché is open.
Okay. Galerie Lafayette is open.
Galerie Lafayette is open. So people are doing a lot of shopping in so far as their budgets will allow.
What about parks?
Yeah, they haven't opened the parks. And there's actually a huge argument going on between Anne Hidalgo, the mayor of Paris, and federal government, so Macron, so the state, as to whether parks in Paris should be open because Anne Hidalgo thinks that they should. Listen, I never thought I would say this. I'm usually much more of a Macron gal. But I agree with her. I think that if you don't open the parks, everyone's just gathered. Like, as soon as it's nice out, and it's very nice out at the moment, everyone's gathered along the Seine and along the Canal Saint-Martin, drinking and stuff. I mean, I don't think you're supposed to drink, but I think they do. And it's much more huddled than if we were all in the Luxembourg or the Tuileries.
We've had our parks this whole time.
No, I know you have. And I actually think, well, I don't know. What do you think about that?
I don't think that the UK is an example. I think that the way everything has been managed here has been pretty bad. And although I actually am very thankful for the fact that our parks were still open, because obviously we have needed to be able to get outdoors. And I thought it was quite funny the other day because it's bank holiday and I went into the park for a little run. And I saw that they had drawn on the grass these huge giant circles that are all separated, like the 2 meters. So you're allowed to sit each group and it's supposed to be household only. But obviously that's not the case. You know, everybody can see that households don't have like 8 children in the UK. I don't think that's
these days.
No. but you're allowed to sit within that circle as long as you don't like interact with the other circles. Kind of thing. So it's like trying to keep people at a reasonable distance, which I think is quite smart. If you are going to allow people to use the parks, I think as much direction as possible is intelligent.
Yeah, but do people actually adhere to the circles?
When I went in, yes, people were sitting, but again, they're sitting in the circles, but they've clearly disrespected the rule, which is households only together, because
right.
it was bigger groups.
Right. So we're allowed to mix with people from other households now, not over 10 people, but you're allowed to see friends. Mm. I have to say, sorry, I'm cutting you off, but I just have to say, I feel like actually France has done it a lot better because it's better to more strict than Italy, because it's better to just be more strict about it and then get it over with and then come out of confinement. I mean, maybe I'm speaking too soon. But...
No, I feel the same way. The last set of rules, which were basically summed up by the key phrase, stay alert, made zero sense.
There used to be a bear in Canada on television who said, stay alert, stay safe.
Yeah, but what does stay alert mean? Nothing. You can't see the virus.
It means that Boris is a friendly bear.
It means he's an idiot, that's what it means. I just think... I just think clear rules are better than vague rules. And in these circumstances, obviously... Everything is, I think I was listening to Pandora on the Hilo saying about this, stay alert and use common sense doesn't make sense to say that because all these set of rules are totally normal. We've never had to apply them to ourselves. Why would it make sense to operate in this new way? It doesn't make sense. We need more direction and clear instructions because we don't really understand what is required of us to make sure that this virus is is at bay. So yeah, I think for me, I just wish things were a little bit more clear.
Yeah, maybe in the fashion world as well, things will start to clarify. But by the way, so that makes me think that I just want to tell our listeners what's going to go on in this show, because we've been messing around with the format a little bit recently. So we're going to do a comp. We've got an interview for you, a great guest later on, our dear friend Dan Thawley, who is the editor of A Magazine curated by Wee. But before, we're going to do a bit more of the chatting between each other, catching up, because we're so separated. We need to catch up, and we like to assume that you want to listen to it. No, we've got some topics we want to discuss around the industry and the changes that have happened since our last record on May 6th. So that's the order of the day. Is that, have I missed anything, Kim?
No, that's all good. I was going to suggest something for my fellow Fashion No Filterites to listen to if they hadn't already, because I've been listening to Louis Theroux's Grounded, and it's so good.
It's so good. It's so good.
I'm so happy you've been listening as well. It's really, he's just so good, isn't he?
How many episodes has he done so far? Three?
He's done four.
Four? Oh, I'm so excited to catch up.
Yeah. I thought the one with, what's her name? Why can I not remember her name?
There was Boy George.
There was Boy George. There was Helena Bonham Carter, who apparently he went to school with.
There's one with Helena Bonham Carter?
Yeah, it's the third one. And it was a very interesting listen, because he does that thing at the beginning where he bangs on a little bit about her ex-husband, and he realizes that he's doing it. Yeah. He realizes that he's doing it, catches himself, kind of apologizes for it, but it's almost too late. He's made the whole introduction about Tim, and obviously he's not interviewing Tim.
Isn't Tim now married to somebody else?
Yeah. They're divorced, and he asks about how it is between them, but he just basically references him. He just talks about him a little bit too much. I just found it really interesting to watch, or to listen to, sorry, a very, very famous and very, very talented interviewer kind of, she's so powerful and she's so articulate and she's also very, very good tempered, but you can almost sense that it's not as much she minds, but she notices that it's happening.
Yeah.
And he realizes.
She doesn't suffer fools.
No. So. And he knows that he clearly realized that he's done it. And I just thought it was a very interesting piece of tension, because that's something, if you were just editing something out, he could have edited it out. He could have, if it was a documentary or if it was a written piece, that would have been written differently. But I just thought it was really interesting to get that awkward moment at the beginning of the conversation where, I don't know, his mind just went to Tim, so he started asking a few questions about that before realizing that probably he talked about that a little bit too much, because they're not together anymore. You can't really start an interview with someone about their ex-husband. It's a bit weird.
I mean, I would prefer people don't start an interview with me about my current husband.
Exactly, that's my point. it should be about her, and it wasn't.
No offense to him.
No, I loved the episode. She's honestly so interesting to listen to and talk about.
Yeah, I love her. She's one of my favorite actresses.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
I see the latest one. Sorry, I've just been going on the Louis Theroux podcast to see, because I've missed some of it. Rose McGowan is the next one, which is a pretty interesting one, because she was one of the big Harvey Weinstein victim whistleblowers, and she's been a major activist in that trial. You get to know her really well in the Ronan Farrow book, Catch and Kill.
Yeah, so that would be my only recommendation of the week, because all I've been doing, Monica, I've given up on culture. I'm just doing a puzzle. So this is who I am right now. I'm doing my puzzle, listening to Louis Theroux, and I can't really, that's all I can think about.
Listen, I understand. And you know what? I did so much of that kind of thing. I mean, not puzzles. I'm quite impressed that I don't think I've done a puzzle since I was 10. And I'm very impressed that you guys are. Because that's really good for your brain, your logical brain, puzzles. But I have to be honest with you, since I've been deconfined, I've been doing a lot of cocktail hour with friends.
And that's nice. Yeah, no, it's just me and my puzzle over here. Just me and my puzzle. But you know what the good thing is? The good thing is my screen time has gone down massively. And I have become weirdly obsessed with this puzzle. I thought it's a really difficult one. My mum sent me, it's called an impossible puzzle. She found it on Amazon, I think.
That is the kind of name that would make me absolutely not want to do the puzzle.
But it's a peace protest and all the little men have the same face. So it's really, really, really difficult. But I'm really enjoying it. So there you go. That's all I have to say. If anybody wants an activity to do next week, I can recommend doing a puzzle while listening to Louis Theroux.
It would be great to get some sort of like mass puzzle, like where you sort of stream all of these people in via house party and you can get people to do puzzles with you, like a sort of nerd cult.
An idea for the future. Is there anything you want to recommend?
Well, yeah, so exactly. So
cocktail hour.
I recommend a new drink. Wait, I'm not joking. I'm actually going to recommend a drink. My friend Alexandra Van Hoot, shout out, friend of the pod. Her mom, Charlotte, shout out, obsessed with you, who is very English, introduced us to the Hugo, which is elderflower. People are probably going to be like, of course, this is the best cocktail ever. I love a bit of Prosecco, but I feel it can get a bit like acid after a second glass. So I prefer this. So you put elderflower, cordial, which obviously all English people know about and not that many other people in other countries. Fill the glass up, the rest of the glass up with Prosecco. So you're only putting like a thumb of elderflower cordial in a normal tumbler, and then you fill it up with Prosecco, and then you get fresh mint leaves and you tear them up and you put tons of them, and it is the most refreshing spring summer cocktail I can possibly recommend. But while drinking my Hugos, I have actually, just to keep my brain relatively functioning, been dipping into, surprise, surprise, my favorite magazine, The New Yorker. And I want to just say, you know, the covers during COVID have been so brilliant. They've really touched my very soul. I got to say, there was one called After the Shift on April 13th. Which showed a healthcare worker hunched over a subway platform who was like physically and emotionally exhausted. And I just felt that it was really true to the emotion of these people who have spent all day saving lives and then, you know, have to get on a crowded subway car to go back. And he's sort of looking into the distance with his coffee. And it's just, it really shook me. Oh, wait, hang on. I've got to talk about the March 30 cover as well.
Because I was going to say.
And it was the healthcare worker Skyping with her family as the dad put the kids to bed with mayhem swirling around her in the hospital. And again, the idea of someone separating themselves from their own children to go and sacrifice potentially their own health. And, you know, as we see in the New York Times cover this weekend, which was broadly shared on social media, so probably a lot of people have seen it, but if you haven't, it was 1,000 names of COVID victims in the United States.
100,000.
Oh, on the cover there were 100,000.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
There are 100,000 victims and there were 1,000.
1,000, you're right,
1,000 were represented because they couldn't put the whole 100,000.
Yeah.
But it was representing the 100,000 victims that have now passed.
Oh, but the best thing about it is that of those 1,000 names, each had a heartbreaking nod to what made them human and not just a statistic. Yeah. So I don't know if you saw, but they had things like Florenzo Almazo Moran, 65, New York City, one man army. Jennifer Robin Arnold, 67, New York City, Broadway costume dresser. I don't know, it's just so sweet. For every name, they added something that made them...
I loved it.
Yeah, it was so good.
They've really got it all figured out over there, haven't they?
It was so interesting, though. I don't know if you thought about this, but it really stood out for me, the fact that they didn't use any images and that they just put all those names on there. And it got me, I geeked out for a little bit and wanted to remind myself when was the last time that an image hadn't been used on the cover to show something so important. And I did a little bit of digging, and turns out that the New York Times published its first issue September 18th, 1851. But the first photos didn't appear on the cover until the early 900s. So that's 60 years later.
Interesting.
And I found this really powerful visual timeline that was created by this guy called Josh Beagley, which really captures the newspaper's change. So like you see for the first, I don't know, 30 seconds, the time lapse, decades of text only. So you see all these front pages where there's only text. And then slowly you see appearing images, which at first they were just illustrated maps and wood engravings and that kind of thing. Then slowly black and white photography comes in. And then as photography comes in, slowly but surely, it just starts taking up half and all of the page.
Well, maybe all this is heralding the return of the written word. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, true. But also some of the more powerful covers that I've been seeing, and we have seen a lot of different kind of creativity, lo-fi creativity, or just, yeah, different to just using a celebrity with great hair, makeup, and a lot of airbrushing on a cover. Using different kind of images. We've seen archival images. We saw the Vogue Italia that started the trend when it ran the April 2, 2020 issue, which was, you know, the plain white cover. No photo, no headlines, just the title on a pure white page as a tribute to the victims of COVID-19. I thought that was beautiful. And then American Vogue used the single Red Rose on its June cover under the headline Our Common Thread. You had Grazia that had designers design the floral covers. I just think it's really interesting to see that suddenly, finally, we're seeing a different kind of cover than the celebrity clickbait.
Absolutely. I think we're forcing editors to really use their creativity, which they do have in them, instead of just slapping a celeb on the cover. Actually, in France as well, French Elle did a great cover with illustrations of French doctors and nurses. I've been really impressed with the way that the fashion press, the press has taken this on. So it's kind of uplifting.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, obviously, like, using illustrations to highlight some of the situations in hospitals is a way to show the grim reality of working in an environment that privacy laws make hard to capture on photo. And
precisely.
Same for the fashion industry. If you can't produce a shoot because you have to stay at home, then there are obviously other ways of being creative. I'm just hopeful and curious to see whether this new wave of creativity carries into the new normal and whether we... I just have really enjoyed having other things to look forward to on my newsstand than just... And I say this without being scathing and derogatory, but, you know, yet another 20-year-old celebrity or singer, you know, like, to sell a Vogue magazine. It just gets a bit repetitive.
Completely agree with you. I completely, completely agree with you. And I think that we used to, before there was this obvious formula, I think that our industry used to really rely on its own creativity and originality in a completely different way. And it's time to break that formula.
And not least because obviously we know that the press has been suffering a lot because of the rise of the internet and social media and the way that we consume media. And perhaps that formula wasn't working so much anymore because perhaps our celebrity content and model content, we're getting it all on social media anyway. So actually finding really different kinds of creative ways to give people a reason to buy a cover to keep for their home and have a physical object that's not just a picture of a celebrity, which maybe we don't want anymore in our home. I think it's really encouraging, and I really hope this continues.
Well, hear, hear, and that leads really nicely onto our guest for today, the wonderful, brilliant, gorgeous, very well-dressed editor-in-chief of A Magazine Curated by Dan Foley.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, Dan.
How are you both?
Hello.
Hi. We're okay. I'm okay. Nice to hear your voice.
Likewise.
How are you?
I'm very well. Planning my return to Paris.
Ah, your great return.
Yes. I think I'll be back on Saturday.
How long have you been away?
Since March 16th, so a solid 10 weeks.
Yeah. How has it been?
I've been very, very lucky where I am here in Pilat-sur-Mer. So I can't complain. I've had the ocean, now the beach is open again. So yeah, it's been a lot of work to put a magazine out during this period. But
right.
I have to say that in a nice environment connected to nature has been really very nourishing.
So what was your daily activity in your former life then?
Yeah, introduce yourself a bit if you don't mind.
So my name's Dan Thorley and I am the editor-in-chief of A Magazine Curated By, and I'm a fashion and arts journalist based in Paris. I'm Australian. I was born in Sydney and moved over to Europe in 2009. And I've been working on this magazine since 2009 as its digital editor. And in 2010, I became the editor-in-chief. It's a magazine that was started in Antwerp in 2001 with the mission of creating Belgium's first niche fashion title, and it quickly became something quite different, as the concept is to invite one fashion designer to curate each issue of the magazine. It's a carte blanche to them to express their interests, their loves, their obsessions, and all about their universe in around 200 pages. And it is something that has really done a world tour in nearly 20 years with designers from France and Italy, from Japan, from England, and from the United States, and really covering a very, very broad aesthetic scope as well. So it started with designers like Marta Margiela and Heider Ackermann and Olivier Teeskens, people that were really based in that late 90s Belgian aesthetic. And then moving forward, we've worked with many, many different types of designers like Alessandro Michele at Gucci. We've worked with Pierpaolo Piccioli at Valentino. And our most recent issue, which is just about to hit newsstands in the coming days and was announced last week, is with Luke and Lucy Mayer, who are the co-curative directors of Jill Sander in Milan.
I'm such a fan of theirs. I'm really excited to read this. But I'm wondering, Dan, how
how
do you put together a print magazine while in confinement? How did you make that work? We're very impressed.
So we have, I mean, it's always a long process, and this is an issue that we've been working on for many months. So certain parts of it were very luckily finished just before legal confinement, and other parts of it were still in the process as we were shut down and locked down here in France. So I was very lucky to have programmed this issue more or less to come out around this time, but it was slightly delayed. But what we'd done was actually done most of the physical productions in the months of January to March already. So what was the biggest challenge for us was that we usually design the magazine together with our team in Cologne, as we work with a wonderful art direction office called Mireille and Mireille in Cologne. And so usually we would have gone there with Luke and Lucy Mayer and whichever designer we were working with at the time for a couple of days. And we sit in the office with them and we design all the pages and we go through all of the process of the structure and putting everything together in person. And this time we were unable to do that, as actually there was a case of COVID-19 in the office in Cologne. Yes. In the earlier part of quarantine. So it was really off the table before travel was actually restricted. So we were forced to do everything a distance and work from home as were everybody else. But what we were lucky was that we'd had most of our photo shoots finished. So one of the challenges was that we had photographers rushing to their labs all over the place to get their prints developed in time. And we did shoots in many different cities, New York, Barcelona, Paris, Iceland. We really were all over the place. Some photographers traveled, others were in their hometown or in their own country where they could drive and do something locally, which was nice. It wasn't all big productions anyway, but it was many small things happening at once. And so we did have the risk of not getting some of our images in time. And then everything was luckily through except for one or two things that we just really had to leave by the wayside. And we set to work designing the magazine from afar, which was very challenging because we had people in different time zones. One of my colleagues, Blake, was in Vancouver with his family, so he wasn't able to come over for the design period. So we had people working from Vancouver to France, to Cologne and Milan, all in lockdown. So it was quite a juggling act. But our last real stroke of luck in the middle of all that was that, in fact, we were for the first time printing with an Italian printer, because they work with a special technique where the side of the magazine is actually invisibly bound. So it's bound with stitches, which are then all these small booklets stitched together and then glued on the side. So you have this invisible spine with the stitches showing through. And they were actually considered an essential service in Italy, even though they were in northern Italy, of course, an area that was very, very heavily affected by the virus. And due to their status as an essential services provider, we were able to print in April. So so that was really interesting and as I said, a very serendipitous experience. But putting the print magazine together in that time, of course, like putting any media together in that period, it was something that had to be very done very sensitively. Yeah. It had to be done with a lot of thought to the world that we were living in at that particular time, as well as the world that we're going into. And we were also very prescient with that because Lucy and Luke's theme for the issue that was decided last July was the idea of human nature and mother nature and the interactions between those things.
Wow. That had been decided way before, because I feel it's so apt.
Yes. Yes. So we found ourselves with this theme that we'd already been working on for months. It was already very much connected to current events in a way. You know, yeah. We were looking at endangered environments. We were looking at different kinds of architecture that was linked to people's domestic lives, the process of them creating artwork. We were looking at also different elements of race. We were looking into all sorts of things that sort of pivoted around the way we deal with nature and environments. It was something that I, of course, had to think about when writing my editor's letter, which is one of the last things that goes into the magazine. Mm-hmm. And we're a very timeless publication. We're not the kind of magazine like you were discussing earlier, whether it's a Vogue or a New York Times. It has to be on the point of actuality of the news and mm-hmm. really making strong statements thereabouts. But what we did have and want to do here was still really acknowledge the fact that we were coming out in this time and in this year, one that we will truly never forget in our lifetimes. And in order to do that, I and Lucy and Luke as well, they also write a letter in the magazine, and we both found our different ways of acknowledging the situation in quite a subtle way. And we also had two brilliant Italian curators who were already contributing a beautiful photo portfolio to the magazine, and they were able to add a new body of work by an Italian photographer in Paris, Giasco Bertoli, who photographed pedestrians on the street from his Paris apartment window.
Wow.
And it's this great bird's eye view of life in central Paris during lockdown. So you see people shopping with masks on, navigating on scooters, just that kind of general emptiness of the streets, which he mixed with many other kinds of photography in that small portfolio. So we do have a little touch of
now,
let's call it COVID content.
New normal.
Without being too explicit in that.
Because I was going to ask you that, because obviously it's different for you because you, as you explained, are producing a magazine that A, is meant to be timeless and people can come and refer back to from the moment that I guess they're interested in the topic or the designer, whatever it is. But we've seen a lot of kind of, I want to call it like new wave creativity, like very lo-fi or certainly a different way of putting covers together, articles together, images together. You've just explained that you didn't have to rely on that because you were actually lucky in that you already had some of your content put together. But we've noticed quite a lot of magazines changing up their content. Do you think that's going to stick around?
It's a very interesting point, Cami. And to your point about us in a way already existing within those parameters, I mean, to go back to this particular issue, you could almost look at it and say, oh, they also did. I mean, if you didn't know the magazine, you could say, oh, they also did a cover that was linked to this new normal, because our current cover is actually made with a Japanese washi paper, or the rice paper that's been impregnated with wildflowers. And it was made by a third generation paper artisan in Japan. And Luke and Lucy had collected this paper on one of their trips there in the last couple of years. And they loved the paper so much and had collected various pieces of it with seaweed and shells and flowers inside it. And their idea was to use this super beautiful paper for the cover of the magazine. And so we went through various stages of research and investigation and testing in the last few months to work out whether that was possible. You know, of course, printing a magazine is printing in volume and we have a lot of quantity, and this paper is something that's very, very fragile. So with our fantastic print company, we were able to devise a way of 3D scanning this beautiful paper, which is a relatively new technique that really shows all of the indents and the textures of a surface. And so we 3D scanned this paper and printed it on an open offset recycled stock. So in fact, when you see it and it's been embossed with the A shape on top, it really, really truly does look like this kind of paper. And there's no model on the cover, you know, there's no headlines.
Yep.
There's none of those things that you know, would often attract somebody to buy a magazine in a kiosk, which of course is often the point of many magazines, is to be seen and to be noticed above, let's say, the noise of all the others. So yeah, you could say ours kind of looks like that now. But back to your point, I think that this has been a really positive thing, because it does show people that there are other ways of communicating, and other ways of being elegant, other ways of being seen. I mean, I think that to your point earlier, of course, the American Vogue cover with the beautiful rose from Irving Penn was one of those elements, whether or not it had some political message behind it as well. And the white cover by Italian Vogue was also, of course, a very important one there. I think a shout out to Vanity Fair Italy as well, who have been doing an amazing job too. They did a great cover with Francesco Vizzoli reinterpreting a Lucio Fontana artwork with the Italian flag, which I thought was great. And they've just done a Paolo Sorrentino cover with the Spanish Steps in Rome, the sort of surrealist flamingo head wearing a Valentino dress in the front, which I thought was great too. So I think there's really interesting ways that people can do existing images. They can, you know, work with great art directors to find more interesting ways of piecing together new things and showing as well. I mean, InStyle US also put a nurse on the cover.
Yeah, I love that.
So, I mean, I think there are people taking it in different ways, and I think it can last. There are certain parts of it that I don't like and parts of it that I do.
Mm. But it certainly felt very refreshing. I feel like that old school model of shoot celebrity, slap a title on it, sell magazine, just feels a little bit just like, it's just a little bit done now.
Yeah, it feels passé. And I think it's reminded us of the fact that we can do things differently and be successful. And on that note, I actually wanted to shift a little bit because, Dan, I remember the first day of Paris Fashion Week I ran into at a show. Like, probably, I think it was the first show I went to. And it was really weird because, you know, we'd all just obviously been in Milan. And some people were behaving like everything was kind of normal. And I actually want to say mea culpa there a little bit. I was definitely more in that mind frame. And you were kind of like, are you not worried about all of us being here, thousands of people in this, squished into this room? I mean, look what's going on in Milan. And as all of this has rolled out, I think that on this podcast and generally our industry has really been questioning the way that we do things. I mean, first of all, I don't know about you, but the fact that our entire industry went from Milan to Paris and so did COVID is potentially not such a coincidence. But also, Dan, I just wanted to get you to comment on, you know, the announcements that have been made by Saint Laurent and now yesterday Gucci about going off schedule. What do you think about all this? And is there a real potential for things to change in terms of the Fashion Week schedule?
And it's funny that you go back to that period because it was such an uncertain time for us all. And I do remember coming back from Milan and thinking that there were a mix of different responses, and I was somewhere in between for sure. Yeah. I mean, I remember one of the first people to go underground and to confine was Loic Prigent.
Yeah.
And Loic sent a local team to cover the Paris shows, and he had his Milan team quarantined very early on. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a drastic measure.
Yeah, he came on right after he came on the pod and was explaining it to us. But actually, yeah, it seems like he did the right thing, doesn't it?
He did. And I mean, I have various ideas about who may have brought the virus from Milan to Paris. And oddly enough, the actual editorial level of the fashion industry has been very mildly affected. I mean, there has been a lovely Sophia Niofitu in London who had a very terrible case, unfortunately, and a couple of other people I've heard of. But in general, it's not something that's gone from front row to front row and affected many, many editors, buyers, and other key members of the industry. I do think that there was probably a second wave of people that had come through from Milan to Paris working in showrooms and working in the industry in general who may have brought it through to Paris as well. But I'm sure that there are many other factors involved other than fashion too.
Yeah, sure.
But it was definitely a hit or miss, a kind of
a difficult
time for all of us to think about that initial 2-week quarantine. But then, of course, you know, many, many other reasons to keep quarantining and resetting that 2 weeks happened later on. So that's its own story. But back to the calendar, and of course, Alessandro's letters that he wrote during confinement were published on Gucci's Instagram over the weekend, and they are a very poetic recount of his reflections on how to move forward. And I think they are relatively abstract still in certain ways, but much less abstract than what Saint Laurent did, which was to put out a big blanket statement that didn't give you anything concrete. And in my opinion, was also a bit of a publicity stunt to be first, to be the first house to say something, to make a statement. All in all, of course, still a positive thing. And it's interesting to see that both from Kering companies and that LVMH has remained relatively tight-lipped until now. So interesting to see what the other big players are going to come through with in the next couple of weeks. I think that there's a lot of things that we can be sure of, and they include that the cruise schedule is kaput, and
yay!
Certainly I don't think that's to say that there won't still be destination shows happening and shows for local markets. The idea of the re-show, I think, is something that's also been a phenomenon in the last couple of years, particularly in Asia, with certain houses replaying a show blow by blow with local models and some international models to a local audience, whether it's for prêt-à-porter when it's hitting the stores, or whether it's for couture clients in emerging markets. And I think we've seen that happening quite a lot, but it's not so publicized on the social media of the brands, but it is publicized, but it's not made such a big thing of. And it's been happening in men's and women's collections by houses like Dior and Chanel, so, and Valentino as well, for that matter. So I think that it'll be interesting to see how those continue to happen, because they are also a different way of showing a collection in local markets. Of course, they're not going to be happening in such grand proportions anymore. But the idea of a collection being given it a certain space in local markets could be interesting moving forward. And as for the calendar itself, I mean, there are still going to be key moments in the year that one will still consider as a fashion week, I believe. But I do think that the idea of having so many collections may perhaps be reduced, and the idea of publicizing them as separate collections will also be reduced. I mean, I think that's something that's been the case for many years for certain brands, is that they have very large collections and only parts of them are on the runway. Other parts of them are actually sold months before. And then, you know, Dries Van Noten is a good example of someone who actually sells the collection before the runway show happens, gauges the buyer's interest in certain pieces and certain ideas, and then puts the runway show together afterwards. And then there are certain parts of that collection that will drop earlier in the season and later in the season, but it's still considered one show. Whereas, you know, the idea of other smaller brands, you know, busting their gut to put four collections out a year, when it's just more about being smart about communicating a certain number of clothes and a certain number of ideas over a certain amount of time. So I think that, you know, Gucci saying that we're going to do two collections a year and that we're going to choose the moment, and it's going to be like a piece of music instead of a, you know, a blockbuster, you know, fashion show. You know, he used that as his metaphor. So I think it'll be interesting. It may also point towards the idea of Gucci embracing the drop culture of streetwear too. You know, I think it's a brand that really lends itself to that.
Yes.
Yeah, and to continue on your mention of Dries, he was part of the retailers and the open letter, the names that signed this desire to change the seasonal shopping calendar and actually selling things according to season. So
yeah,
instead of selling bathing suits in November and coats in May, the goal is to sell clothes in the time of year when they're worn,
Exactly. Can I just say that this is the number one question that non-fashion, or as Cammy and I sometimes call it, fashion muggles, but we say that with a lot of respect, ask me is, and it's, I guess to us it seems obvious, but it's not really that obvious. Why don't they just put out the clothes when we need them? I totally get that question. Like, it makes a lot of sense. That question even comes more often than why do the models look anorexic? Even more often. So there is something to be said for it, because let's face it, not all clients work in fashion and are having to review and put out press about it. That's not really what concerns them, is it? I like the open letter. But what do you think, Dan?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it was an interesting time a week or two ago when Dries spearheaded that first initiative, and then the Business of Fashion picked it up and published a think tank that they'd been working on privately prior to that time as well, which Dries was not a part of, called Rewiring Fashion. And both of those things emerged at a similar time. They don't have the exact same message, but they have similar messages, and both are definitely catering to the sizes of brands that are such as Dries and Tom Brown, Philip Lim, all these designers who have signed it. I mean, there's hundreds now, and there's many, many retailers as well who have signed it. And it's really also proof that there shouldn't be just one fashion calendar that should work for everybody, because there are so many different factors at play, and there are different size brands, and there are different markets that are requiring different things, just as the luxury conglomerates have different needs as well to nourish their store networks with product too. So I think that what we're seeing now is that there is no right answer just yet, and more than ever people are going to have to start dancing to the beat of their own drum. And if there can be certain guidelines for that in place, fantastic. And if there can be new buying seasons and new periods and new ways of showing people that this can still exist without the exact same prior rules in place, it's fantastic. But I thought it was interesting. I was on I was on a industry Zoom call with the many players in the Australian fashion industry, a new initiative there called hashtag We Wear Australian, which is a bit like a Common Thread in the States, pushing for local craft and local making. One of the buyers there said to me that, you know, she's often profited from the fact that, you know, the clothes were coming at the wrong time because it works for Australia. So
right.
That's something interesting to note too. And then further to that, this was Eva Galambos from Parlor X. She also said the fact that collections have become an enormous, have come a long way to become more trans-seasonal. And I think that's something that we all have to remember too, moving forward, is to keep pushing that message of the trans-seasonality of things and the fact that something shouldn't just belong to one time of year. And also that we just get smarter with the kind of fabrics that we're using and the way we're putting collections together to make garments that are functional.
Totally. I mean, let's look at fashion in a more international way. And it's not just Europe-based anymore. And you as an Australian see, you know, flip seasons. I, as a Canadian, have grown up with it not actually being summer until June. Like, it's just not warm.
I never saw a winter coat until I was an adult. Like,
oh, that's
no
so
one
funny.
Owns a long coat.
I never took off a winter coat until I moved to Europe. I'm just kidding.
Ugh, I'm just boring and European, guys. Sorry.
Yeah. You're French, so that's what everything was being designed for back in the day. But things are changing. Now, speaking of change, we wanted to ask you about men's versus women's. And now, obviously, the menswear week has been cancelled. That was coming right up. What do you think about the idea of designers showing their men's and women's collections? I mean, and obviously this has been taken on board by a lot of designers anyway, but do you think that we should continue to have a men's week and a women's ready-to-wear week, or should they all be mushed in together? Does that show a collection in a more interesting way?
I was asked this question the other day, and I'm going to return to the same answer that I gave then, because I still believe in it, and it also involves Dries again, who was one of the people who suggested he still likes to show his men's collections separately because he doesn't want them to be thought of as a footnote to the women's collection and to give it its own platform. And then, you know, that was also there's also been an about turn there in other houses too. And Gucci was one of them as well, who decided to re-show a men's collection alone this year. I actually wrote a piece for Vogue Global, the Vogue Club, and it's up on vogue.co.uk and a few other Vogues in February about the gendered fashion show. And yeah. And so I did definitely look into this topic quite extensively. And I have to say that it's an interesting one because you have this phenomenon of menswear that has just exploded in the last 15 to 20 years, and the idea of it as a real market, which it wasn't before. I mean, menswear was so ultra traditional and bogged down in old ideas of what men's luxury was. And it's just exploded in a wonderful way, as has non-gendered dressing, which is another idea that has come out of these talks at the moment, with the idea of even, you know, the Printemps department store right now is showing mixed clothes and sizes on their new website. It's not a new thing at all. Selfridges has done projects like that as well, all to varying levels of success. But I think that it really is a case by case situation, and you can't just say that women's and men's fashion week, in whatever way that will be in the future, can be together, because unfortunately, the saturation of brands in the world is enormous, yeah. And the saturation of womenswear is enormous, and menswear, and they all cater to such different kinds of customers. I mean, in menswear, you have the fantastic trade fair Pitti Immagine in Florence that happens in June and January normally, and that shows, you know, everything from all the denim brands to Italian suiting, and you really see this huge breadth of the kind of things that that men wear, and the kind of different boutiques, the different price levels. I mean, it's a huge industry now. And likewise, a women's fashion week in Paris or in New York or in London, etc., is really full of different kinds of brands. Of course, there's an element of glamour and excitement and color that comes from a women's fashion week, because it's just in general, the way that women have been allowed to dress and have dressed in throughout history has been more flamboyant than men, more theatrical. There's been so much more embellishment and silhouettes. So there's this kind of idea that men's clothes are much more linked to masculinity and much more linked to practicality, and you know, so that things are much more sober, and of course parts of that have changed, but there's always going to be that imbalance of what one kind of fashion means and what the other kind of fashion means. If the internet is going to be our frontier of those things happening, let's say, at the same time, then maybe it's okay. But if there's going to be singular platforms, and even if that's a fashion federation, or if that's Instagram, I mean, there's only so much space for so many things at the same time, whether or not it's a physical space. And I do think that spreading things out is still a good thing. And I do think that menswear has a big voice now. And in a way, what's interesting is that the, let's say, part of that new normal will actually allow for a little bit more of a middle ground for the way women might want to dress a bit more like men. I mean, that was already happening as well a lot too. And I think that, you know, the time that we've all spent recently focusing on comfort, focusing on indoor activities, focusing on the time we can spend outside and how we spend it, which is more active than previously. I think that all those things are leaning towards the fact that maybe evening wear and party dresses and things like that may subside a little bit in the in fashion's view of what a woman wants to wear and how she wants to feel and look all the time. I mean, I can look at both of your Instagram accounts and say that you've definitely been wearing the pants in the last couple of months and weeks. So
so true.
It's part of trends as well, and we might see a lot more women adopting the way that men dress in their day-to-day life, especially if we're going to be working from home for a little bit longer, which I believe is going to be the case.
Well, I'm for that. Can I ask you a basic question? It's very basic, but you're a pretty snazzy dresser yourself and so elegant always. And I was wondering if you could give us maybe your three favorite menswear brands.
For me, as an editor as well, I think it's really important to support friends and to support brands that I really believe in.
Yeah.
And, you know, working in the luxury sphere is amazing. And it's really interesting, of course, to have access to seeing, you know, many of the more extravagant things done by big houses and that are available to customers today. But it doesn't necessarily mean that I want to wear all of them or wear all of them in my daily life.
For sure.
So I think that there's an interesting mix, especially for me right now, as I'm revisiting my own consumption and how that will happen moving forward. And I think that there's definitely a little bit more of a traceability aspect and a transparency aspect in what I'm what I want to purchase, and that doesn't necessarily mean buying things that are called sustainable and things that are, you know, necessarily entirely green. But I do think people that are making an effort and are making things locally and are making things in an honest way are going to attract my attention more than others. And I'd have to make a shout out definitely to my friend Spencer Phipps with his label Phipps in Paris, who I've been wearing a lot of during lockdown, and he makes really great menswear that is inspired by his own love of the outdoors and of sports. He's a rock climber. He actually used to work for Dries and for Marc Jacobs, and his line is very traceable, and you can go on his website and find out all about what you're buying. And it's comfortable, it's relevant, it has kind of really great storytelling about nature and about our connections to nature in the graphics, and I think it's a lot of fun, and it's really easy and comfortable. I'm also a big fan of Marni in Milan, and I love what the creative director Francesco Russo is doing, both for men and for women. So Marni's a big one for me. And I'd have to say I've been also wearing La Mer as a daily go-to. So I think that the kind of brands that can give you understated elegance without necessarily being too showy and being comfortable are really important at the moment, and just creating sort of easy, comfortable silhouettes that still look elevated. I mean, I've barely come out of my Il Pelicano Birkenstocks either, so it'll be strange to start wearing real shoes again.
I'm writing all this down for Mark's AW 2020 look.
I'm also a big fan of what Louise Trotter, our mutual friend, is doing at Lacoste.
Yes. And,
yes.
I think, you know, as well, for a shout out to her and the way she's taking a heritage brand at the moment in a really great new direction.
Completely agree.
I wanted to end this, Dan, on
I mean, I saw a really interesting piece by Sarah Moa in Grazia last week where she talks about how fashion, who normally and always gets written off as frivolous, has really come into their own during this time with designers creating masks for people, PPE being sent around, people collectively getting together and thinking up new ways of both of helping their communities, etc. Do you see fashion as having a role to play in really making sure that the world post-COVID is going to adapt to this new normal? What I'm really asking is, do you still have faith in fashion and its sort of transformative power to change things?
I do. I do have faith in it. I do believe there's a very, very long way to go in certain elements. What I think is interesting from this period, and maybe Sarah touched upon that, is that it's really the small players that have stepped up really well.
I agree.
And of course, the ones that can, on the bigger scale, have done their part too, like LVMH working on producing gel in their fragrance factories and things like that. I mean, I think many houses, Chloe has been creating PPE in their ateliers. And, you know, people have done different things in different ways. I think the Italian houses were also fantastic in fundraising for their local hospitals and things. And I think in general, what this has taught us is that fashion is a local business as much as it's a global one. And, you know, even to see, for example, a big, huge fashion house really calling out a certain Italian hospital or a specific charity rather than necessarily a sort of blanket ideas of what it is to support people has been really interesting to watch. And then also to see Gucci as another example again, but really focusing on awareness and education for people. So their pairing with the World Health Organization was really a very educational way of teaching people what to do at this time and using their enormous network to actually educate people rather than having anything to do with clothing itself. So I do believe that this is going to be an interesting reset. And I've, you know, I think there are certain elements of it that have the possibility to be kind of cringeworthy. And I think we're going to see some collections that people are going to put out that, you know, will be very linked to their reflections in confinement. And, yeah. And that can be a really great thing. And it could maybe be a little obvious too. So I think we'll have to see the way people treat this subject in a graceful way. And I hope that it will also make them not only reflect on a thematic way, but on an actual practical way, because I think fashion is very, very good at themes and in storytelling, but it really now shows that today that's not enough and that we actually have to apply these things all the way down our supply chains, all the way through to our end customers. And I'm not talking just, you know, an organic cotton t-shirt. I'm talking about the packaging. I'm talking about the coat hangers. I'm talking about all of the shipping, everything. You know, we just think that it's the end garment that's the one thing that's causing problems, but in fact it's the whole infrastructure that we've created that we need to sort of dismantle in a way.
Hear, hear.
But yeah, I think small players are doing a wonderful job, and I think that the B2C that Instagram has really propagated through these amazing engagement directly with people to speak to their designers, to have a real connection with them, it's been great. And I think that the idea of crowdsourcing opinions through channels like that is also going to really really move us forward, because people are listening to their consumers and they're making those changes and they're reporting back on them. And there's a sort of accountability today that can't be ignored.
Thanks so much, Dan. That was you're so insightful.
No, it's been a pleasure to speak to you both. I love having a chance to reflect on all these things together, and I know that your audience will be interested to hear some different points of view at this time when we're all getting our heads around it. So, no, a total pleasure, and I hope we can chat about it again soon in the new normal.
Well, we hope so too.
And see each other. That's my big one. I really hope we can see each other soon.
Well, Dan, thank you so much. And where can people get their copy of A Magazine Curated By?
Oh, well, it's on sale at amagazinecuratedby.com. And I mean, we've already sold it with Wonderful Idea Books as well. I think they're sold out already, but we'll be in a lot of physical stores around the world in the next couple of weeks. And hopefully they'll all be opening up again for you. But they also have some great, you know, delivery services happening with news agencies and great bookstores. So look out for it online. We'll be tagging people too on our account who have it in different markets, but it'll get out there, and it's a beautiful object.
That cover sounds outstanding.
Yeah, it's really a collector's item. We're so happy, And that amazing spine means you can open the whole magazine the whole way. You know, there's no gutter, which in magazine world is very exciting. And as I said, it's really nice to have something that we can be proud of as a recycled object and something mm-hmm. that's really really of now.
And the future of print. So good to hear all of those things.
I think that it's going to be a lot of cutting the fat, unfortunately, in the industry, but we're going to get to the good stuff. So that's a good thing.
Amen to that. I guess that's all for today, folks. The good news is, Monica, I am actually traveling to France later on this week.
I can't believe it. I can't believe we're going to see each other face to face. Well, mask to mask. It's like cheek to cheek.
It's going to be quite an adventure. I am both really looking forward and dreading the Eurostar, but we have to come over for personal reasons, which actually are very out of our control. But I'm really, really, really looking forward to a change in scenery and can't wait to experience the world deconfined. So, Monica, I guess I will see you next week, and to everyone else, see you next time.
Thanks for joining us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.